It's Ivory Coast 2, Nigeria 1. They have turned it around, the hosts here. Adingra with the cross from the left-hand side. Sebastien Allaire tried to get a touch. It may well have come off a defender, but it's deflected, certainly beyond the goalkeeper. Unbridled joy as Ivory Coast are AFCON champions for the third time, the first country to do it on home soil since 2006. They've beaten Nigeria 2-1. They had to come from behind to do it, and they've done it the hard way in the tournament. Struggled to get out of the group, sacked their coach, then somehow scrambled their way through the knockout rounds with some dramatic late goals.
It's been a really strange tournament for my country. Their reaction was absolutely amazing, and the whole country is buzzing. We are all buzzing. We are so happy.
Kalo Choa there, jubilant after the victory by Ivory Coast. Now, in fact, it was exactly, or virtually, 70 years ago this very year that AFCON began, when in 1954, FIFA finally voted to recognise Africa, still throwing off, of course, the shackles of colonialism, as a confederation. And now the story of those first 30-odd tournaments is brilliantly told in a book by Ben Jackson. It's his first book, I hope it won't be his last, called The AFCON, The African Cup of Nations, The History of an Underappreciated Tournament, published by Pitcher. I'm delighted to say Ben Jackson, the author, joins us now. Good morning, Ben. Congratulations on a fantastic book. And you say very close to the start of the book, it's a tournament like no other, down to the fact it's held in the middle of European seasons and also once every 2 years. And when it first started, I didn't realise this, only three nations took part. Tell us more about that, if you would, please, Ben. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks you so much for having me on. And yeah, that is remarkable when you kind of look back at kind of the tournament we've just had and the amount of teams there, to then trace it all the way back to those three starting teams. So yeah, we had Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia, South Africa were initially there to kind of get the ball rolling on the tournament, but obviously they were deep in the kind of throes of the apartheid regime, and kind of they offered to basically only send either an all-white team or a coloured team, as they called it at the time, and the other team said absolutely not, you're sending a mixed team or you're not sending a team at all. So South Africa were kicked out before a ball was even kicked. And yes, Sudan, Egypt and Ethiopia were the first three. And I'm sure listeners will probably be thinking, Sudan and Ethiopia, like really? They're not really kind of footballing nations as we think of today. But they were there at the beginning. And it's just a fantastic story of how just three nations, and then you kind of look ahead to now and how they were able to grow this tournament massively. And as teams kind of came out of kind of the colonial rule, they joined, and we get kind of this incredible kind of festival of football that we have today.
And then, of course, it seems to be a key moment in the early history of AFCON is when Ghana joins under the very football-minded president, their first kind of native president, if you like, Kwame Nkrumah, who actually set up his own football team, the Real Republicans. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, he did. He was a massive kind of advocate for football. He invited Stanley Matthews over for independence celebrations to play. I think he ended up playing four Hearts of Oaks, one of the kind of big sides there. So he was quite kind of keen to
And in fact, you say, I think his team beat Blackpool and drew 3-3 with Real Madrid. I mean, they were real players, obviously, back in the day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He kind of brought the kind of national team into that side as much as he could. And he was quite kind of pro to kind of push football as a way of kind of showing what Ghana could do. And then for him, it was kind of showing what the continent could do as well. This kind of like pan-African idea of kind of we're kind of more than just these kind of under colonial kind of slave sort of thing. We can do stuff that people don't think we can.
And there's also, I think early on, there's talk of what you call what it's called the Jollof Wars, which is Nigeria-Ghana. Can you tell us, what is Jollof then, Ben?
Yeah, so Jollof is kind of like this spicy, savoury rice dish that Ghanaians and Nigerians kind of cook. I've only actually ever had kind of a Ghanaian version. I haven't had the Nigerian version, but it's very kind of like West African dish, and they both do it. But there's debates, I guess you could say, between the two nations as to who does Jollof the best. And it's kind of this long-running saga alongside kind of the football rivalry. So it's kind of been co-opted by both. So you've got the football rivalry, you've got the food rivalry. Like, if you kind of noticed kind of social media, Ghanaian social media was very happy after the final whistle on sure. Sunday evening seeing Nigeria lose. But yeah, no, it's a spicy dish. And if you meet anyone from those countries and you ask them about Jollof and ask them what they think of the other one's Jollof, you'll get a robust response, I can imagine.
And it shows you how times have changed and football's changed. One of those early games, maybe even the first one, I can't remember now, but was decided not by extra time or not by a penalty shootout, but decided by drawing lots. It sounds very Victorian.
Yeah, no, the kind of lots do stay around for quite a while in the tournament as kind of a way of getting through kind of awkward situations, I guess you could say, where they didn't do penalty shootouts or anything like that. And I think it's one of those things that we're now so lucky with kind of how the professionalism of the game has changed. We have kind of enough time to play a tournament and get through a tournament. But you go back to these days where it's all very, it has to kind of go to the minute and go how it did. And when it didn't go that, the lots of Jordan, when you were on the other side of it, I couldn't imagine anything worse. And imagine now, kind of, if England were knocked out of a World Cup on drawn lots, we'd be livid, wouldn't we? Like, we'd be absolutely fuming. And these teams were angry. Like, don't get me wrong, they obviously knew it was kind of a possibility, but any team that got kind of knocked out by drawing the short straw were pretty angry about it.
Some amazing players as well. I wish I'd seen play, because sometimes these matches weren't even filmed or broadcast or whatever. An early Nigerian star is a man called, I probably mispronounced it, Elkana Onyeali, who sounds like an amazing player.
Yeah, no, Onyeali, and he's just kind of one of these early players, like you said, that we didn't really get to see. So yeah, we had like Onyeali in Nigeria, we had Jaxa from Sudan. He's kind of considered to be the best Sudanese player to ever play. Menjitsu Worku from Ethiopia as well. Emmanuel Poku from the Ivory Coast, who's kind of considered to be the early Drogba, if anything. Like, kind of Drogba was always kind of compared to him. There's all these incredible players that I obviously didn't know about them when I researched the book, and just kind of discovering their incredible stories was part of the kind of fun of it. And just thinking, what would they be like if they'd kind of come in a later era? Like, where would they have ended up?
I mean, it's a fascinating book, folks. I urge you to get hold of a copy by Ben Jackson called The African Cup of Nations, The History of an Unappreciated Tournament, published by Pitch. There's also, of course, that period early on. I think it's, again, that chap, Kwame Nkrumah, his team, the Ghanaian team, hire, I think it's a Hungarian coach, and then they follow up with another European coach. But then, of course, it seems the traffic's gone the other way, which is so many more players from Africa are playing in Europe and elsewhere in the world. That I think, was it the Senegalese side that didn't have a single player in it that had a domestic, that was playing in the domestic leagues in Senegal last time around or the time before?
Yeah, no, it has. We've really kind of seen that shift. And that's what was really interesting, like seeing in these early tournaments, like in the 60s, 70s and 80s, like most of the teams were domestic players. You'd have the odd one that maybe had gone to France or kind of England or anything like that. But very rarely would you have a whole team that was playing outside of the country. Whereas now it's kind of rare the other way, like you say. It's kind of, you look at, yeah, Senegal, barely anyone playing domestically. Nigeria don't have as many as they used to have. Cameroon as well, like all these kind of nations. I guess Egypt are probably one of the only ones, and kind of the North African sides will still have quite a few kind of domestic-based players because of kind of the strength of their leagues. And South Africa are actually a kind of prime example of that, because financially, most of these players are making a very good living in South Africa. It doesn't really make any sense to leave. So they stay where they are and they play the domestic league. So they're one of the real kind of old school kind of AFCON sides in my mind that still have these domestic players. But I think that's what makes it such a great tournament now, is the international kind of flavour of it, with all these players coming from all over the world and all these different teams to play.
And I mentioned, and you say it in the book, about doing things in its own way. I mean, it was, at times, it almost felt like a kind of soap opera, the last AFCON, with managers being dismissed and sacked, and then like Ivory Coast, who were managerless effectively, go on to win the home tournament.
Yeah, I mean, it is just kind of things that happen within it that don't really happen in other tournaments. Like, it's very kind of unconventional. And it's not the first time that we've had kind of managers sacked during the tournament. I think there was a tournament in the late 90s where two managers get sacked during the group stages, and neither of them go on to win it, not what Ivory Coast did, which is, yeah, I think pretty unprecedented. I can't imagine it's ever going to happen again where we're going to have a manager sacked halfway, not even, yeah, kind of midway through a tournament, replaced, and that team go on to win it. I mean, it kind of, maybe being the host nation, they have a little bit more kind of momentum, but I just can't imagine it being kind of an effective strategy for any kind of international side going forward.
And you've caught African football the way many of us catch measles, but you went over there as a teenager, as a coach, is that right?
Yes, I went over in early 2010, maybe 2011. I went to Sierra Leone to do some football coaching, and I think I said in the book that most of the kids were better than me anyway, the teenagers are really, really good. But it's that kind of infectious love for the game that I've found in Sierra Leone. And that was a country I had no idea about. And then I've travelled a little bit more around other countries. And it's kind of like everyone always says, like, Africans love football. And it's kind of like, oh, dude, is that everywhere? Is that really the case? But everywhere you go, it is pretty much the case. Everyone will, if you want to speak about football, like, people are so like passionate about the game. Look, we saw that, didn't we, with the scenes in Ivory Coast at the final whistle when they won it, like, in the stadium. It was just an incredible, incredible atmosphere. And yeah, if people have ever thinking or kind of worried about going to an African country or a continental country just because based on like kind of media reports or kind of images that they have, I'd say you just got to kind of ignore all that and just go, because you will find this incredible place, this incredible people, and so many countries that are just so different, but the love for football is just consistent among them all.
Great photographs in the book as well, folks. It really is a good read, but it's also exhaustive in that you get full details in it, as well as you might expect. Almost reads at times like an official history, but you are critical, or at least honest, about some elements of the game. You mentioned the boycotting of South Africa because they wanted to field black and white teams pre-apartheid, you know, when apartheid was still going there. Also, you've mentioned how other countries, other regimes, like Colonel Gaddafi's Libya, tried to usurp their football, the football element of their country for political reasons. And again, that led to them being, I think they didn't host the Cup 1 year, is that right?
Yeah, so they were meant to host a couple of years ago, but obviously with the Arab Spring and everything that was going on, they didn't host. But yeah, they were fascinating because Gaddafi was, he doesn't really like, he never really liked
football. In his green book, which I bothered to read years ago, he couldn't understand why people would stand around watching football. Quite what he wanted to do, I do not know, but it wasn't for him really, was it?
No, he was happy for people to play. He recognised the benefit of the playing side. But then in 82, he hosts and Libya make the final and lose, and that's the closest they've ever got. So I can't imagine he was not enjoying watching the game back then.
Ben, you've been a fantastic guest, mate. We really appreciate your time this morning. And the book's got wonderful illustrations as well, folks, as I was saying. It's called The African Cup of Nations, The History of an Underappreciated Tournament. It's a great read as well, published by Pitcher. Ben Jackson, the author, was our special guest this morning. It's our TalkSport Book of the Week, right here on Extra Time, the overnight show on TalkSport and Talk Radio, where we're live till 5.